It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and it's October 25th, 1976, Dialogue Conspiracy number 240. I was concerned about the contacts of Jimmy Carter with the Trilateral Commission, and I have certain doubts about the parties that are running for president this year. But I really don't mean it to be as flippant as I carried it. And I guess that my disinterest in the two candidates did come over on the show. And I do have some comments to make on an even more serious part of Gerald Ford for just a few minutes. And that is the fact that Gerald Ford was very much a part of the assassination of John Kennedy cover-up, that he was appointed to the Warren Commission by Richard Nixon. And in order to vote for Gerald Ford, you have to realize that he's part of that old bridge mix that Flo Kennedy talks about. Flo Kennedy is a lawyer, an activist in the women's movement, and we did a show together last night on WBAI in New York City with Ted Gandolfo and Bob Fass, and we were talking about Jimmy Carter, and Flo was saying how important it is to get everybody to vote. And don't fall for that apathy story that the news media is carrying now and trying to project. And she calls Gerald Ford more of the old bridge mix, the chocolate-covered coated nuts that you pass around at bridge games that conceal the nuts that are inside. The Kennedy assassination era from 1963 has been covering up conspiracies and murders ever since that time and government crimes. And we all know that Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford to the Warren Commission. And Gerald Ford wasn't just a person who sat back and was uninterested in what was happening or didn't know that he was covering up. The minutes of the Warren Commission meetings are available, and every lawyer on the staff was from the Central Intelligence Agency, which would make Gerald Ford a president representing the Central Intelligence Agency. At the very first meeting or the second one, it was the first meeting that Gerald Ford attended of the Warren Commission in 1964. He got evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald, allegations that Oswald was an agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he put that in a book he wrote called The Portrait of the Assassin. But he left out of the book the same part of the document that was presented to them at that time, that Oswald belonged to the Central Intelligence Agency when he was overseas. And the meeting of January 21st, 1964, Earl Warren ordered the cremation of the body of Lee Harvey Oswald, because he said, it's a direct quote, the country can't stand another shock and somebody might get to that body. And Gerald Ford was present at that meeting where the destruction was discussed. And there are many people working now with the committee in Washington to open up the investigation of the killing of John Kennedy and Reverend Martin Luther King. And the important thing is that all the major researchers of the assassination series in the United States, whether it's the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King, the John Kennedy assassination, and even in the SLA case with Donald DeFries, there were doubles that the intelligence community created. And Oswald had four doubles that were using his name and resembled him in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And at the time of the assassination, one was on the upstairs of the Texas School Book Depository and left the back of the room, and one was on the second floor having a Coke and left from the front of the depository and got into a car and drove away with agents from the intelligence community. It was their car. So there were two Oswalds that left the Texas School Book Depository, and one of them was shot by Jack Ruby, and one of them was buried in Texas outside of Dallas. And that person had guards over him 24 hours and three shifts and was buried under 2,800 tons of cement in a special coffin. And yet Gerald Ford was part of a meeting at the decision to cremate this body, so that history is deprived of knowing whether, in fact, it was the Oswald that was in the Soviet Union or his double that was transferred in the Dallas jail at midnight or 12:30. It was actually early in the morning on that Saturday. One Oswald left the Dallas jail and another one checked in. So the Oswald doubles has come up through all of the research Most every researcher who's done any extensive work is aware of the fact that Oswald had people impersonating him and using his name. And Gerald Ford took that and sat at the meetings and didn't ever entertain the idea that anybody but Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. So it's very hard for me to vote for Gerald Ford, and I do urge you to vote for Jimmy Carter. We don't know that much about him, but we do know about Gerald Ford, and we do know about Robert Dole and his voting record. And I think one of the important issues is the kind of vice president we would have. And I think we have a good selection. I don't think how you could get a person more fair in terms of housing and health and pollution and ecology than Fritz Mondale. And I think that that is a big consideration. I don't see how anybody could compare Dole to Mondale, and I think that you have to vote the whole ticket and have some kind of security to fall back on. I have a picture here from the Houston Times. It's a photograph from last Friday, the Houston Post, and there's a GOP rally, and it's got a picture there of John Connally and Nellie Connally and Senator Paul Lazalt, Nancy Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Robert Dole, and Elizabeth Dole. And there you have Connally, who was Secretary of the Navy at the time that Lee Harvey Oswald was in Navy intelligence, who'd been corresponding with Lee Harvey Oswald and knows that Oswald was in Navy intelligence. Paul Lazalt is the man running Ronald Reagan's campaign, who was the former governor in Nevada that brought the Howard Hughes empire into Nevada and was selected by the Hughes people to become president of the United States someday to represent the interests of the Hughes Corporation, whatever that is. And then Ronald Reagan's campaign was run by Lazalt and the Hughes money and the Hughes operation and Robert Dole. And when I see that picture, which I have here from the Houston Post, it reminds me that that picture alone is enough to make me go and vote for Carter. As I say, his selection of his vice president and the view of Dole and who's behind Dole and Gerald Ford, it goes back to every one of the political assassinations on up to the present time. And I think that you have to consider that if you want to expose the continuous series of murders that have taken place in this country and all the pain and the assassinations, you can't put people into office, vote them in, or look the other way and expect any changes. So I think that in terms of assassinations and conspiracies, and that's what this particular program is about every week, I just think that you should vote for Jimmy Carter for that reason and keep those people out of office that would block investigations, because Carter has said that a government shouldn't have secrets and that if he were president, information in the National Archives would all be declassified and that he would go into all these assassinations. And I think that's the kind of leadership we need. He obviously has nothing to hide or he wouldn't say it. And I think that we should give that kind of support. Norman Mailer was on television in New York City last night, and he was talking about the Kennedy assassination and the links to the Hughes Empire. And he was with a panel of other people, and he was saying that if Gerald Ford wins the election in November 1976, then the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, should support the researchers like myself and get a group together of independent researchers to the tune of maybe $2 to $3 million to fund. The best thing would be to get a computer and fill the various names in that all of us have, the dates and the times and the foundations that are involved in these assassinations and the particular lawyers, and run down with a computer the names and places of where they were in their involvement, and force Gerald Ford out of office in that way. I know when Richard Nixon ran for election in 1972, it was just the November after Watergate. The Watergate arrests were in June, and I didn't see how the elections could go on and why the elections weren't stopped. And I wrote an article saying that Nixon would be out of office because of Watergate. And even though he did win the presidency, he was pulled out of office. So if Gerald Ford wins the election, I hope that there would be an impeachment of Gerald Ford for covering up the Kennedy murder and that people would rally and get this information out. And I do believe that there are enough people around the country, the stature of Mailer and Flo Kennedy and other people now, that are ready to move on this evidence, that they haven't done it since 1963, but they don't like the direction the country's going in. And the evidence is there anytime we want to pull it out. The minutes of the Warren Commission meetings and the tapes of Gerry Ford that he says are in the Justice Department hands. I'm sure that they're locking these up or erasing them at this point, the Watergate tapes, but there are enough witnesses to work if he wins the election, but it would be much easier to have a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president and hopefully get to some of these assassination facts and end this killing syndrome. I do want to talk for a few minutes today about a gentleman I met through my radio programs and through my research on Dialogue Conspiracy, and the name will ring a bell to those of you that are up at Vacaville and Folsom and Soledad or Tracy. It's Robert Hyde. And from 1974, 75, I was doing quite a few radio shows on Dialogue Conspiracy about Robert Hyde. And I did want to bring it up today because sometimes we talk about the news in general and assassinations and conspiracies, but it's interesting to see how the research goes, say, from my newspaper clippings and my radio program into affecting people's lives. And Robert Hyde is out of prison now, and I played a big part in that, I'm proud to say and glad to say. And I wanted to share some of the experiences with you because a lot of you who listen to Dialogue Conspiracy know the name. And for those of you that are new to listening to it, hopefully maybe I can turn some of you on to some of the pleasure of doing research. There's a lot of time that you give up things that you want to do, and you spend a lot of time writing letters and making telephone calls. But once in a while, you see the fruits of that effort. You feel inside you've done a good job, but once in a while, you feel the fruits of these efforts. And one of those payoffs, I call it a payoff, you don't ever expect, but one of the really happy things that happened to me yesterday was when I was in the study, and I'm working on an article now for We Magazine, and I was very intent on studying, and somebody was standing outside my window, and a member of the family said, "Somebody's out there." And I had a slow reflex because I didn't jump. I wasn't even hearing, and I looked up, and there was this gentleman out there, and he looked, and he kept smiling, and I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Robert Hyde." I just nearly fell over. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. I had seen him out at Soledad Prison when he was in solitary confinement. At that time, he had about 20 pounds of chains around him, and he was ash gray, and he was about 20 pounds thinner and very frail, and he was always abused, and they were constantly trying to kill him, and he was being poisoned, and he was kept in a little cubicle about 2 feet by 2 feet. There's a visiting room in this most isolated section. I think it's O-wing, where two people in separate cells, and you can go in and go through various doors and gates. And I had seen Robert Hyde a couple of years ago. And, of course, this was a different person altogether. He gained 20 pounds and pretty light blue suit and big smile. And he was always cheerful in spite of what was happening to him. And he came and visited with a friend, and it was really great to hear him, and he could give a rundown that he couldn't do while we were corresponding, of course, or we've talked a few times on the phone since he's been out, but we hadn't met. And he was saying what effect that Dialogue Conspiracy had and the work that I had on various people in the California prison systems at the time where there was a lot of tension and a lot of heat going on. I first learned about Robert Hyde through Jack Kimbrough. He's a researcher in Los Angeles who's been working on the Robert Kennedy assassination, and Kimbrough was working with Robert Hansen, who was an attorney for Cernan at the time, and they had a correspondence from Hyde, and Hyde was familiar with evidence in the John Kennedy assassination and the Robert Kennedy assassination, and he had documents that are very important to solving these crimes from an inside level, from the intelligence operation level, and members of his family, closest members of his family, have been in military intelligence all of his life, all their lives. And he had access to information and documents on the killing of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And he knew too much. And as a result, in Los Angeles, he was charged with snatching a purse from a woman and taking something out of her purse, which blinded her. And he was put in prison. And there was a note inside his jacket, never let him out, you know, keep him in and never let Hyde out. And after, right now, he has a lawsuit. I had gotten attorneys for him that stayed with it, one attorney in particular. And his case has been settled, and all of his charges have been cleared. He spent many, many years in prison, in the California prison system, and all the charges against him were cleared. And he now has a lawsuit, which he said he owes to me. He had studied law, but he filed a suit against the U.S. government for the infringement of his constitutional rights. Now, at the time that I learned about Hyde, he was about to go to Vacaville. They had called him into a room and said, "Hyde, you know too much. We're going to do experiments on your brain." And when you hear him tell it, it's one thing to write it. But when he's sitting in your home and you realize how close he came to it, and God knows how many I haven't been able to save or we haven't been able to stop, who have had their brains removed with either needles, he said, between the eyes, the lobotomies or psychosurgery and experimentation, which he said goes on in Vacaville. Now, the government reports, the Rockefeller report, the church report, Senator Church report in 1976, came out with disclosures of the MK Ultra plan. That's the CIA plan that used six different drugs and chemicals and injections and sociology and psychology to alter the personality, to change human behavior, to change the mind. And the intelligence community developed those down to a very fine point, and Vacaville was one of the places that they were using it. So I wrote a letter to Robert Hyde when I heard that he was going to have the psychosurgery, and his wife had visited him and left crying and called her lawyer, and the lawyer said there wasn't anything the family could do to interfere with prison policy. And so I wrote a letter to Hyde and said, I heard that you're going to have psychosurgery, and I was studying that year the use of electrode implants and medications to change personalities of people by the intelligence community and the Army, and using prisoners and mental patients as test cases. So I wrote to Hyde and said, I understand this is going to happen to you. And he wrote back and said, that's true. And then the next time I wrote to him, he had been moved to Vacaville. And some of you will remember the long saga of Mae Brussel and Hyde. I called the warden up at Vacaville, Clone, I believe his name is, and I said, if you cut up Robert Hyde, I'm going to sue you for $1 million. And I based it upon the opinion that in Nuremberg, the trials there, we saw how many people sat back and did nothing. They had a choice, and they only obeyed orders, which is what the warden was obviously doing from the CIA in this case and is still doing if he's testing up there. And I called up and I said, if you take the brains of Hyde, you take my brain, because it's like the first person that's put into a gas chamber in a concentration camp leads to the 6 millionth, and we can't let this go. And the warden at the time wanted me to speak to the hospital ward where Hyde was, and I said, no, I wouldn't. And I was carrying this running script on Dialogue Conspiracy through KZAP at the time, talking about this, and within listening ear, not of Hyde in the special cell that he was in, but people up in the Sacramento area who responded with letters, thank you, at KZAP for the response and the letters, and for the people in Carmel who played a part also in this Hyde saga. So the warden wanted me to talk to the medical unit. I said no, and this is advice for you people who want to help prisoners, who have family in prison or know somebody who is in trouble. You don't go down to the lowest level and say, what are you going to do? This is what Mrs. Hyde did, not out of any malice, but just out of ignorance. She said, are you going to do the surgery? And they said, yes. The approach you take is that you call and say you don't dare do the surgery. Robert Hyde said, this is what worked, was my calling them and saying, you can't do it, and I'm going to sue you. And then I sent a letter to my lawyer and a letter to the warden and followed it through that I want the records to show that if anything happened to Robert Hyde's brain, that they would be responsible, that there was no medical reason and it was a political reason that he was being wiped out. And so he was removed back to Soledad, and the warden didn't want him there. I called the warden at Soledad, and they sent him up to Folsom, and I called Mr. Gunn. I think he's retired now. And I gave them hell, and I said, look, they're sending Hyde up there because they're going to kill him, and there's a contract to kill him because he knows too much about the murder of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And the warden up there said, hey, this woman's on drugs, and he went around telling people that I must be crazy the way I talked to him. And when I saw Hyde yesterday, he said to me, they really respected you. The wardens and the guards who know about the radio show or got the letters or calls really respected you. And I said, oh, get off of it. They thought I was crazy. And he said, no, that before he left Folsom, the warden called him in and said, you really have a friend there. You really have someone, you know, sticking up for you. So Hyde moved back to Soledad, and there were three other tries on his death. And thanks to people at Soledad, they were able to listen to KLRB. I don't know how many of them can have FM radios now. He told me once that there was a riot after one of the shows that they weren't supposed to be listening. In fact, I got letters. One man had made an antenna out of coat hangers so that he could hear Dialogue Conspiracy. And there were three people, three different people that were hired not hired, they didn't weren't paid, but they were put in the cell next to Hyde, and each one of their families separately had come to me and told me that one a husband, one a son, they were threatened they'd never get out, never get any chance at parole if they didn't kill this man. So I again got in touch with each of the wardens and wrote to my lawyer and told them to write to their lawyers and to place lawsuits. Well, then Hyde was moved down to Chino, and I called Chino and wrote down there because I couldn't talk on the radio to any of the people down there. And even his sick mother would send me letters. He wasn't getting any sunshine, and she was afraid she'd die and never see him again. And I carried the messages then down to Chino. And one of the people who was at Soledad with Robert Hyde, he was told he'd never get a parole. He'd killed three different people. And they said, well, but we'll fix the record and let you out if you'll kill Hyde. Well, what Hyde told me yesterday was that they called him in and said, if you'll erase all the record that you were asked to kill Robert Hyde, we'll give you parole. And so he was released, and these people were released alive and for all purposes are not in Soledad now. So at the time I spoke at San Jose Civic Auditorium in 1974, there was a lawyer in the audience who heard me and represented him and is representing Hyde now in his case against his constitutional rights. So he did get out. He was out a few months, and he was living up in Modesto, and he did call to say outside of our other meeting at Soledad we'd get together. And so yesterday was a really happy day because I could see that using the research, studying the mind control, studying where the operations were coming from, the techniques they were using, I had more information to back up my charges or accusations at the various places where he or other people are confined. And I again thank KZAP in Sacramento for those people in the area that did contact the prisons, because Hyde feels now, of course, he's on the outside, he's not in, but he feels that the pressures were released, the tensions were released, and also a lot of it was released after Ronald Reagan was no longer governor and Jerry Brown took over. There is a more humanistic approach. There's less chance of pitting the various people against each other. And the men in prison may not, I don't know how much pressure they feel. You might write and let me know if things have calmed down a little or if you're still segregated and pitted against each other. If it's happening, I'm not getting that much mail to the effect. I'm not getting letters of desperation of this same kind of tension. I'm sure there's tensions there, but not the same kind of tension that was going on in 73, 74, 75. And so I felt good when I saw Hyde, and I did want to pass this on to you because, as I say, the research has an operational level besides the academic thing of giving lectures or giving radio shows or teaching the college class, which I did with Ray Fabrizio on assassinations. There's a practical level of using your research, a humanistic level that can be applied and take place, and then it gives those people inside some hope if you take an interest in their cases and try to stop this mad killing. See, everyone who is killed on this kind of a basis, kill this man he knows too much, is just as horrendous as killing President John Kennedy. I am not only concerned with who killed John Kennedy, but I'm concerned with the 800 or 900 murders that followed since then, or the thousands, or the many, many thousands. And the assassination syndrome was described in the paper just this morning. Senator Church was in San Francisco saying that the anti-Castro Cubans that were trained by the CIA have a capability like their own private army. So if you were on an airplane going to Barbados recently and the plane is blown up and 70 people are murdered, people are now confessing they had the name of a CIA man in their pocket, the name of an FBI man. They tried to blame Fidel Castro, just like they tried to say Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist. Henry Kissinger said the CIA wasn't involved in the crash at all. The truth is that the assassination syndrome is taking place, whether it's a president going down a motorcade in Dallas or whether you're on an airplane. And it's these insane killings by the hands of a very, very few people. They're not that many in number, and the syndrome is always the same, the pattern's the same. And once we put the story together and combine the many assassinations, which I've tried to do, and add up the total modus operandi of the individual assassinations, you can halt this madness, whether, as I say, it's a president of the United States, or whether it's one lone man sitting in a prison system. The principle's the same, the methods of going about investigating are the same. And I felt really confident in meeting Hyde and sharing this with you who listen and try to understand dialogue conspiracy. Well, I have a Lulu. This article just blew my mind, and I want to spend some time on it. I almost wanted to spend the full 45 minutes on it because it is indicative, again, of the whole government structure, and it has to do with an article in the New York Times, and you might write this date down. If you want to go to the library, they microfilm or keep copies of the old New York Times, and I think this is one that you should have as a collector's item. The lead story, it's on page 10, and it's the October 14th New York Times, last week, or 10 days ago. This is the way the article reads. The records show Hughes borrowed $39.5 million shortly before his death. This is a New York Times article by Wallace Turner. And the reason I'm going at length about this today is that it didn't make the Monterey Herald or the Los Angeles Times or the San Francisco Chronicle or any of the local papers. It didn't make the AP, UPI wire surfaces even. And it is so shocking that I want to share this article with you and discuss a little bit. This is a byline of San Francisco, October 13th. I don't know yet why it came out of San Francisco. This is the article. About 3 months before he died, Howard R. Hughes borrowed $39.5 million from three Houston banks, the Texas probate court records. Now, 3 months before Howard Hughes died, the man was down to 80 pounds. He had a bleeding head tumor just when he left Mexico. That was just prior to moving to Acapulco, to Mexico. He was in the Bahamas. He was living in a room. The windows were boarded up. The man had $2.5 million. He had cash that he could get his hands on, of unlimited cash, anytime he needed it. He wasn't spending a cent. His aides were living high off the hog, their cars, transportation, and fine hotel housing. Whoever or whatever Hughes was a scabby, bed sores, emaciated corpse, really just about a corpse. The attorney general in Texas is trying to settle the Hughes estate to find out who handled what at what stages of Hughes' life, because he obviously couldn't even raise his hand or sign anything. And when the body, if it was his body or anybody, entered in Mexico, his aide, Mr. Waldron, signed his name and was caught with forgery. So 3 months before Howard Hughes died in December, if you visualize the state of the body, $39.5 million was taken from three Houston banks. The article goes on, as with many other disclosures about the business practices of the reclusive industrialist, the papers showing the loans raised more questions than they answered. Now, I'll read a little bit of the Wallace Turner article, and then I'll interject my opinion. The way the New York Times writes it, it says that the practices of the reclusive industrialists raise more questions than they answer. But they still assume, the establishment media, Wallace Turner, the New York Times, still assumes that the industrialist is doing all the secrecy, that these disclosures have to do with the business practice of the industrialist. It has to do with Mr. Davis, the Chester Davis, the attorney for Hughes, or Mr. Gay, Bill Gay, or his secretary, Nadine Hundley, who would get the $39.1 million. Obviously, Hughes didn't get it. So the question raised has more to do with the people around Hughes than it has to do with any reclusive industrialist. And they say this reclusive industrialist raises questions, and he's nothing but a pile of bones at this point, allegedly a broken hip and filled with cocaine or Novocaine or no dental records, no Novocaine, but drugged to the teeth and out in a coma shortly. And the loan of $39 million has more to do with the people around Howard Hughes than Howard Hughes. He hasn't been seen since 1957 and had a hemoglobin down to about 8 with practically no ability to reason or think. Whoever the body was, that was years ago. Well, it goes on, this was filed in a probate court in Harris County, Texas, by the Texas Commerce Bank. He owed $28 million to the Texas Commerce Bank, $6,250,000 to the First City National Bank of the Southwest, and the Bank of the Southwest, $5 million. So the interest since December on the estate now is $41,444,000. It says the banks acted under Texas probate rules that required the filing of their claims within 6 months. Now, these three banks in Texas gave the Howard Hughes secretaries, or aides, $39 million in December. Where did the money go? It says Mrs. Hughes' closest surviving relative, Mrs. Annette Loomis, his aunt, and her son, William Loomis, are co-administrators of the Hughes estate under the probate law. The California and Nevada authorities claim a voice in the probate of the state. Probate court officials said Ms. Loomis and her son had indicated in their handlings filed by the bank that they would approve the payment and it would be made by Judge Gregory, which means that Howard Hughes' ancient aunt and Howard Hughes' cousin said, in effect, well, we're going to inherit a lot of money, maybe $135 million or more from Howard Hughes, so we'll go ahead and pay the loan. But the strange thing is that the aunt and the cousin are so willing to pay the $41 million from their hunk without asking the people who had Howard's body where the money went. Now, it isn't usual that families just say, oh, we'll pay $41 million out of our inheritance, when the person that they inherited anything from was lying in a bed that was boarded up with absolutely no medical attention, no dental attention for years, an 84-year-old doctor that was vacationing in the Bahamas, and this scabby, bleeding body, skin and bones, not eating any food, and no medical care at all. Why are the cousin and the aunt so willing to hand over $41 million from their inheritance that they're going to get without charging the aides with either kidnapping of Howard or burglary, taking this $39 million from their estate? What right do they have to have it? It's cash that was delivered to the people around Howard Hughes with no accounting. Did they can't invest it. The war contracts money comes in. Hughes gets $1.5 million every 24 hours from us anyway as taxpayers. The Hughes Medical Institute has a tax-free gimmick. They own a big hunk of Las Vegas with skimming money and investments that are doing very well. So where did the $39 million cash go? And the only answer that I think to this question is reasonable is that these people had kept this Hughes hoax going since 57. And I have to ask the question, I can't say it's a fact, but what I have to ask the question is it possible that they were getting to turn in this scabby old body? The hoax was going to be up for various reasons, and that this would be their payoff for the finale, that they would move to Mexico, fly the body in, and bury it in Houston, and everyone would get a piece of the Hughes estate. Because there is no other reason for this kind of money being spent by his aides without an accountability of where it was spent, what it was for. Why did Howard Hughes need $39 million in December when you see the condition of that body in April and it couldn't just get that way in 3 or 4 weeks? And why is the family so willing to pay off the debt of $41 million? They haven't seen that cash, and that's a lot of money. And no explanation. His medical care and his medical expenses did not come out of this loan from December, because the medical expenses ran into almost like $750,000 in the last 4 months. But that's already been tallied into the probate, and I've seen those expenses that they listed, the hotel and the transportation, the airplane, and medical equipment or movie projectors, and their food and entertainment, the aides and salaries. So there's a cool $39 million plus interest that was directly handed from Houston, Texas banks to whoever kept the body of Hughes. The New York Times article went on to say knowledgeable sources have said that when Mr. Hughes died, his wealth included $200 million in a cash note bond or payment of sizable legal fees, and that and to pay some of the $25 to $30 million to renovate and expand the Desert Inn Hotel and the Las Vegas. The explanation here is that he had $200 million in a cash note bond and that $25 to $30 million would renovate the Desert Inn or Casino. Now, those bills should be presented, because was there a cash investment 4 months before Howard Hughes died people weren't certain of his mental condition, why would Houston banks, why not other banks in the Vegas area, turn over this loan? And the important thing is that just before Howard Hughes died, around December, at the time that this loan was being made, there was Jack Anderson that was writing articles that he believed Howard Hughes was dead. The IRS was going to go in and declare Howard Hughes legally dead. The Security Exchange Commission had a lawsuit and still has against Hughes Air West, a multi-million dollar lawsuit against Hughes, and they were demanding to see Hughes or come to court because they thought he was dead, and they had hearings in San Francisco where Hughes was supposed to appear, and they knew that he wouldn't appear. So how come this loan was made at a time when most people believed Howard Hughes was dead and certainly very shaky in health that the loan was made? But here's some more mystery about it. The New York Times said the barest amount possible of paperwork behind the loan was filed in the record. But what there was there showed a strange business practice. You see, getting back now to interpretation, Hughes could be afraid of germs. That was a great cover story. He could be bashful. That would be a great cover story to hide, keeping this man hyped up or doped or steal his empire or his tool bit for drilling oil or whatever. You could use a lot of excuses for not having Hughes be present. But once Hughes died, all the mysteries could end. If you have a legitimate operation like the Summa Corporation and you have legitimate attorneys like Chester Davis and people around you, there has to be very little excuse for mystery. Even when he died, there could have been a will, and there should have been a will and a power of attorney. And there should be very little mystery about Howard Hughes. But the New York Times says the barest amount possible of paperwork behind the loans was filed in the record. And what there was showed a strange business practice. Now, if a hotel needs improvement of $29 or $30 million, the Desert Inn or the Casino in Las Vegas, if they needed curtains, they needed tables or slot machines, there doesn't have to be anything in a business thing to be shady. And the thing I'm stressing about this that's so important is that the Hughes Corporation has been the front for manipulating the electoral process of the United States ever since John Kennedy was killed, and beginning in 1946-47 when the National Security Council was formed and when Alan Dulles was a director of the CIA and Richard Helms was a deputy director and became director of the CIA. Hughes has been a front for funding many operations that Congress has to go into, and I am afraid to list. I have talked many times on the tentacles where they reach our life, but if I get started on that, it'll take up the remaining time. The point being that in 1972, the committee re-elect the president had their own secret funds, and they met over in an office of the Mullen Company that had been a CIA front in the 1960s. It funded the Free Cuban Committee that gave Lee Harvey Oswald money and set up counterintelligence operations and was a dummy front for Hughes and CREEP. That same Mullen Associates is where E. Howard Hunt worked and G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord, where they planned the Watergate, what they call the Watergate caper. And they had $10 million there, which Louis Tackwood, the agent provocateur, said was the amount of money needed to plan riots in San Diego. And these gentlemen were planning riots and demonstrations in Miami. So with the 1976 election coming up, you don't have CREEP. You have tighter election laws. You have more control on the money, who's spending it and where it's going. So I have to ask another question. Did this $39 million go into drapes or rugs or slot machines at these Vegas hotels or go into any improvement, this cash, cold cash money, or did they take this $39 million cash and divide it by 50 states and send it to congressmen, Republicans, Democrats, sheriffs, district attorneys? 1976 elections are coming up. People are running for elections in our area. I've mentioned it before, whether it's Bert Talcott or Leon Panetta, or you take wherever you are, if your money's coming in from out of state, and I've mentioned this, is it cold cash under dummy fronts that the candidates say, I trusted, I didn't look into? I mean, is it seven money washings like what happened at the Watergate, where money could come from the CIA and go down to Chile and then to Mexico and then to Houston, Texas, and then up to Minnesota and then to Washington and then down to Bernard Barker's bank in Miami and then to the CREEP offices and the Mullen offices into the pockets of the Watergate men? Seven money washings clings every responsibility that the congressman has. But this is an election year, and the election year has always needed millions and millions of dollars to pay off the opposing candidates so that you have a one-party system and not a spunky two-party system. So $39 million is missing in December, and the election and the campaigns are going to be working their way up through April and May and June. And that's why this $39 million should be accounted for once and forever by the Hughes aides where it went. Because if it was a legitimate operation that Howard Hughes needed $39 million cash, as I say, just before he died, and I doubt it, why is it a report that the barest amount of paperwork was there and they had a strange business practice? If they needed the money and they have the Hughes Medical Institute and the skimming money from Vegas, what was so strange about the loan? Now, the New York Times goes on. It says, last December 31st, at a time when Mr. Hughes was living in Acapulco, Mexico, the Texas Commerce Bank made five loans. The first was for $1.5 million, the second for $5 million. They were both to Mr. Hughes personally. Now, these loans were to Hughes personally, and you can imagine this vegetable, comatose, scabby, sword body that I'm talking about, who, according to best accounts, had no mind for years. The money went to him personally, and they were secured by a promissory note to Mr. Hughes from the Hughes Tool Company, dated December 31st, 1970. Now, that is really scary, because in 1975, they're giving Howard Hughes a loan just before 1960, and the security is Hughes Tool Company, dated 1970. Now, Hughes didn't use the tool company name at all. The article says that was the name on the date of Mr. Hughes' personal holding company, but he sold that name in 1972. He sold the company that manufactured bits for oil drilling. He sold it in 1972 to Mr. Holliday, who managed it earlier. The holding company now that took the money from the sale of the Hughes company is called the Summa Corporation and has assumed the obligation of the promissory notes involved. So why didn't Howard Hughes, if he needed the money in 1975, December 31st of 75, and he borrowed $39 million, why didn't he use Summa Corporation instead of a company that he no longer owned and sold, and the promissory note goes back 5 years before he borrowed the money, and he doesn't even own the company? The New York Times said also on December the 31st, Mr. Hughes borrowed another $15 million and gave a promissory note for December 31st, 1966. The Texas Commerce Bank made another loan of $3 million and a fifth loan for $3,750,000, secured with stock from the Sands Hotel, the corporate name of the hotel in Las Vegas that Mr. Hughes owned in his own name, and another bank in Houston, Texas, January the 9th of 1976, gave him another $6,250,000. So that the Hughes Tool Company was sold in 1972. The loans were secured under the name of Hughes Tool Company and not Summa Corporation. There is absolutely a bare minimum of paperwork, and the New York Times' Wallace Turner says it showed strange practices. Well, I copied this article and sent a copy to the Attorney General in Texas, John Hill, who's aware of this case, and I've been corresponding with him. I sent a copy to Jack Anderson, and you might follow up with letters to editors or radio talk shows and ask, who got the $39 million? Did it go to fund the 1976 elections? Some of my work is hard sweat, and some is psychic, and some is just logical deduction. And I think that this $39 million that's missing is a very important clue to the candidates and the elections that are taking place now. And we should pursue it if we can, and I shall, as long as I'm able to, and try to put some tracing on it. Well, that's it for today, Dialogue Conspiracy. I'll see you next week, coming from Carmel, California, and take care, and we'll be back with you next Monday, and have a good week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.